Hello, welcome back to Physionatters. We've brought the show back after our successful Kickstarter campaign. So the two Jacks jumped on a live stream to discuss recent controversies such as Cordura Equina syndrome and vigilante justice in physiotherapy. If you want to get in touch with us about anything in the show, then just give us an email on inquiries@choosehealth.co.uk. Just put Physionatters in the subject line and it'll get through to us. We'll reply to as many as we can possibly manage. We hope to bring these off-the-cuff chats to you once a month if we can manage it, and that's how Physionatus will run from now on. We'll push the good ones out onto the main podcast feed, but you can always find them on their original live stream. This one had to be on Periscope, which was unfortunate because Facebook was down at the time of recording. But never mind, you can find it on our Twitter feed. And we'll see you again next month.
So we're going to record it on here, and if it's any good, oh, I need to stop that buzzing. If it's any good, then we'll put it on the main feed, and if it's not, then...
We'll delete it and pretend it never happened.
Apart from the three people that watch it on Periscope. So heckle away, and we will check in on the comments in a little while. But Jack was coming up to stay overnight, because you've got a course in the morning, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, up in Rochdale.
But marvellous, very agonisingly close to my neck of the woods. Yeah. And so he's staying over, and I realised he was going to be here in time to potentially show him around quickly, because you've not been here before, have you?
No.
And then talk about, there's been a lot to talk about, really. Well, main thing, of course, is that our conference tickets went on sale, and so we've got an early bird going on for that. The program will be out very soon. We didn't actually launch the program until it was totally finalized last year in August. So we're going to be ahead of schedule a little bit on that, because it will be out in March. So people have got that to look forward to. I had a few confirmations today come through on email from speakers, but I don't know if I want to say yet.
Don't jinx
it. I want to build the tension. But yeah, that's pretty cool. So people need to visit. What's the website?
Buytickets.app. /reformMSK.
Reforming MSK. Yeah. Or reform.physio/conference, and that's going to be where all the information about the speakers as it emerges, and we will break that news as they come. Discount code. We should know these things.
First 50.
First 50.
First with an F, 50 in numbers, and there's about 10 of them left. So if you want 20% off, you've got a few chances left.
Yeah, and we separated off the people that are in the working groups. We've separated that off, and they've got a different access code, so which gives more people probably a chance to get the early bird. But yeah, we've already got, if we count for speakers and staff and stuff like that, we've already got 100 people that are going to be there. It's already, you know, going to be, it's clearly going to be much bigger than last year, and last year felt busy. So yeah, pretty fucking exciting, pretty cool. So I want to talk about recent scandals. We will start with Cordura Equina. You've made your name in rheumatology now, but that is considered, whilst not urgent serious pathology, it's still in that sort of triage, masqueraders conversation.
It's definitely a medical problem, yeah.
Sure. So what's been your hot take on Cordura Equina conversation bubbling up again?
Well, it's been the last 10 days, really, hasn't it? It suddenly exploded. I can't remember exactly when the Graham Wilkes blog got posted. That was a little bit longer ago, and there was a little bit of chatter about it with regards to this bilateral sciatica being sufficient to refer to A&E for a Cordura Equina suspicion. And I think there was a little bit of chatter then about whether that was sufficient or not, and that kind of thing. And not really that much came out of it. It was an interesting blog to read and quite a nice read. And then I don't even know what set it off, but suddenly Twitter, like, all hell broke loose, didn't it, with people saying various things about what Cordura Equina was and when we should suspect it, how we can suspect it, what we should do with them. And it culminated in this sort of, I suppose it was like a response blog from the three guys that we would know really at the top of the Cordura Equina sort of game at the moment, or the most recognised names, Chris Mercer and Laura Finucane and Sue Greenall, who I happened to be on their spinal masqueraders course the week before that blog came out. And they responded, and I think they echoed everybody's sort of feelings, really, that it's a minefield, Corda Equina. And I think we're, certainly as a physio profession, I wouldn't like to comment where the medical profession are, but I think the physio profession are suddenly realizing that this is something that we could fall foul of. And I don't think we're up enough on the legal situation, because Corda Equina can be seriously life-changing if not caught quickly enough. And I think the Americans have led the way in litigation, and I think that's coming across our way. And I think that's something that we're suddenly realizing that could be a problem with us, with this growth of first contact practitioners and complex caseloads going up. I think it could be a big problem for us. And certainly my take over the last week or so of the blogs that have come out and the comments that have been made is that I think personally I need to be more cautious. I thought I was relatively cautious before, but I think I'm going to have to be more cautious. When you read some of the comments about the legal situations of there was one case that, and I can never remember his name, the chap that does the really good legal things.
Martin Doctor.
Yes, I can never remember his name.
I thought you were meaning like a page.
No.
I know the case law.
I'm pretty good with names.
You were going to quote some case law.
No, Martin Doherty's name just always blanks on me. But he put a case up with about, I think it was a GP case, and he'd been brought up 6 years later for a Corda Equina case. And it came down to his note writing and these sorts of things. And you just think, you know, what am I doing now with my patients? How am I managing them? What questions am I asking? And how am I writing those notes explicitly enough that in 6 years' time, if I get called up in front of a panel of my peers, I can justify that I did the right thing for that patient? Mm. And, you know, the blog from Chris and Laura and Sue was really, I thought, quite useful in that, you know, using the term safety netting. So my take on the words on that sort of phrase would be, you know, you obviously got, say you've got someone with back pain who's got ridiculous symptoms. They might even have some muscle weakness, something like that. And to safety net them would be, you know, obviously go through your Corda Equina syndrome questions. They may be all negative. But to then give them a solid piece of information they can take away by a printout or a PDF on the computer that they can have, which highlight the Corda Equina symptoms and what they should do if they get those. So that would be safety netting as opposed to obvious escalation to A&E. Mm-hmm.
And when you say you want to be more cautious, you're not meaning more cautious to refer. You're meaning I think I will now,
and this is the first time had a conversation not that long ago about Twitter's not changed my clinical practice in a while for various reasons. But I think that this actually will.
Because you're so ahead of the curve.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I'm at the pinnacle of all clinical things.
No, but it has, yeah, I know what you mean. It's dropped off that.
It anyway. Has dropped off a little bit. But I think I will start sending that hard copy stuff out to more of my back pain patients because of paranoia as much as anything else. I think there isn't sufficient guidance of a line in the sand saying, if with this set of symptoms, you will be okay. I don't think we have that. And I worry about things like, you know, we know that people are walking around with undiagnosed cord compressions and all sorts of stenosis, they're asymptomatic, all sorts of stuff. I wonder how many people are walking around with an asymptomatic significant Corda Equina compression. And you sort of, you know, you could assess any low back pain patient. They present with just purely back pain, no ridiculous symptoms whatsoever. And then let's say they go to their GP or they go to orthopedics or they go to another physio who does a defensive MRI, for want of a better term, and it shows a really big cord compression or a Corda Equina compression. Where do you stand then? You and I, if we had that clinical conversation, you'd say, well, they had no symptoms. They didn't report anything like that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, this is where it brings to those, I think we should zoom in a little bit on those blogs, because I've touched up on it a bit today, and really, I'd be honest, I visited it thoroughly for the first time today. And both of the topics that we're talking about, I'd otherwise skimmed just because of being busy, and so it was good to be able to zoom in for this. I don't think the timeline is irrelevant for the course that you went on and things like that. And so I think it kind of frustrates me in you having been there, and you reflected back to our team for our internal learning and our feedback loops that we all have of the fact that Graham's blog went off, it provoked some conversation. As a general rule, it was clear that there was something new in there. Mm. And the new thing was that there was an increased caution, especially on bilateral sciatica, which is certainly a more common red flag than, say, a bladder retention or a loss of saddle anesthesia, saddle paresthesia even. So that was new, and therefore a discussion emerged from that, and it was likely that that wasn't going to be, it's likely that wasn't going to be any final word, and he presented it as such. But then there was a course with Sue Greenosh, Chris Mercer, Laura Finucan, about those, and in that course there were therapists that work at Connect that were expressing that their pathways had changed and that there was some confusion over that. Now, that then can't be coincidental that a few days later they then make a response, and the title of the blog being A Disconnect with Connect, or Disconnecting from Connect, or something like that, wasn't it? That timeline's surely relevant. Therefore, it would have made sense almost for that conversation that's emerged to be appropriately referenced, I thought. But you were there. Were you surprised, therefore, to read the blog, and it was almost as a detachment from the interim 10 days or whatever it had been, even though there'd been significant events in there that had informed their chatter?
Yeah, I think when I was on the course, I think it did come up quite early in the day. As you say, there were Connect staff there, and, you know, reasonably, with those three guys in the room, they brought that question up, because I think it wasn't so much they had a confusion over sort of the pathways they were supposed to be following, but it was more of a it was new, it was different to the clinicians, and they were getting some pushback from A&E because obviously their referrals were going up, as they would, because you were referring people you wouldn't necessarily have referred before.
Yeah,
and the response then from Chris, Laura and Sue was, as I would have expected, you know, it was along the lines of clinically reason. We're all autonomous practitioners with regards to cauda equina, which is a bit of a grey diagnosis when you take it subjectively, you know, if you think of how many people do you talk to, especially the sort of older female population who have some bladder irregularity or increased, you know, frequency or whatever, and you're always trying to play off that judgment as to, okay, is this new, is this related, how is this onset, etc., etc. And they put that across perfectly, and it echoed how I would have the patient in front of me and question them regarding cauda equina and refer appropriately. But there wasn't any mention of them responding particularly, and I think,
or in the response, perhaps reference the conversations that had informed
now,
that.
Yeah. Now,
or the fact that there was more confusion, I think it'd give more credit to the conversation.
Now, whether they'd started writing that response before the course, or whether they might have even finished it by that point, I don't know. And, you know, maybe there's a possibility that the way the blog is written is quite a formalized way of writing it, which is quite nice for the scenario they've done, and whether they wanted to actually reference what was quite a casual conversation, they might well have actually decided not to put that in there, which I think, you know, I can easily justify either way. Yeah. But it did seem to, they were aware of Graham's blog, but it seemed to be a bit of surprise that that was them sort of, I don't want to use the word policy, maybe more guideline would be for Connect staff. And it was a bit of an unusual situation, because I obviously was aware of Graham's blog, but I didn't know that that's what was changing. I didn't think people would be referring to A&E on the basis of purely bilateral sciatica.
To zoom in on that, Graham's blog really, and it was when I read through it today, it really does flow very nicely, and it tells the story of the oohs and ahs and the dilemmas that they face as a company for how to crisp up that policy. Because what the second blog does, and what you've said and I thought at the time, which is that it's there's nothing necessarily new there. It's really nicely worded. It's the oohs, ahs, index of suspicion, all the things that we didn't touch cauda equina in our podcast with Andrew Cuff, but it's similar sorts of logic-based reasoning that meets a threshold of index of suspicion that then triggers a referral that's then, you crisp that up with appropriate language in letters to then indicate what should or shouldn't happen and why, all that sort of stuff. But what Graham was saying is that based on legal consequences before, and the fact that they needed to a set of self-protection, They then reference this Dr. Nick Todd, who, if he is, say, a called witness, expert witness, or the referenced material, the go-to source in the medical fraternity that's credible, and the three big names in our profession, as big a names as they are, and the quality clinicians that you would put up against anyone's clinical reasoning. But if we say we've got what's considered a world leading or at least British leading expert, that then he's going to be an expert witness on these cases. You can imagine that then under the political furore that would occur around especially an independent sector provider, it seemed to me a very reasonable reason for dropping that bar be based on this Dr. Nick Todd's guidance there. Now, my frustration with the first blog is that Graham, perhaps there's a, and it's concise, and I'm not known for conciseness, so I can understand why he's done it, whereas I wouldn't, is that there would be another paragraph in there that really articulated the oohs and ahs of challenge at the interface level, and the frustration that and the backlash that's inevitably going to come from your spinal fellows on call that are taking these patients and getting pissed off at that. I think it would have been worth referencing that to understand the primary care challenge at point of contact. Now, that's not Graham's role, and it's also I'm making his blog longer because that's me, and so I can understand why. But generally speaking, my frustration with the second blog is that when it references where Graham's then, and Graham clearly explicitly says about this Nick Todd's information and why, if that is what he considers to be a sufficient red flag for immediate investigation, you can see why that's... When they then reference it in the other blog, they're not dismissive of it, and they're appropriately academically complimentary, the great work of whoever it was. But they then quickly reference it as being, as you'd expect from a spinal surgeon, okay, which is trying to then slide off it, in a way, because they're trying to say that our context is sufficiently different for us to only nod to that. But then they don't necessarily explain the fact that there's no question that everyone would prefer for this to be embedded within clinical reasoning. But Graham's just saying that there's a legal and an objective marker that's been placed by a medical fraternity that means that whilst we'd prefer this, are we legally safe? And that question still remains. That's what amazes me, is that you're not going to... I think that the second blog is sort of probably where I'd say the majority, especially in ESP practice, your first contact, or especially the Twitter arty, generally speaking, that's in keeping with what everyone would think. It'd seem a bit rash to send everyone to A&E with just bilateral sciatica. But therefore, almost that felt like what could have been the first block. And it's sort of, I feel like I've seen it appropriately praised for it being thorough, but I think I could do with it probably sharpening up and addressing some of the specifics in more detail, especially that paragraph about where Graham's referencing. So that's a frustration I've had with both blogs. Do you feel that there was anything new in your understanding from that, say, second blog and the course and things like that, that's made you cautious, as you mentioned it? Or is it more that Graham Wilkes, with reference to that material, is making a sufficient case to actually lower your clinical...
Yeah, level? I think it's that latter one, I think. I don't... You know, if I think back to my journey of learning about Cauda Equina syndrome, and I think, you know, it's this thing where you initially start to hear about it as an emergency. And you know, when you talk about physiotherapy, there aren't that many emergencies that come through the clinic. Not true you know, we talked about rheumatology. That's a medical, it's a, you know, things are better if they are treated early, but it's not an emergency. And Cauda Equina is a true emergency. And I think that in itself, we are not used to as physiotherapists. We're not used to dealing with. And I think that it sort of has come on my radar more and more and more as I've built up more of a responsibility over the caseloads that I've had. And now it's got to this stage where, as I said, there's now a legal implication to this. And the way that Graham's blog is set out, and as you mentioned, the way it implicates that lower bar that potentially is something that you could quite easily skip over on a lot of... I mean, if I think back, I mean, how I first started working in MSK 8.5 years ago now, how many back patients have I seen in that period of time? I worked in an SPA clinic. They were all back pain patients. how many of those patients have I seen with bilateral sciatica? And you think, you know, if it's, even if, I mean, it's too high a number, but if it's 1%, I mean, that's a number per year. You know, let's conservatively, I'm up at 50 or 100. You know what I mean? So even if it's 1% of them, that's one. Like, is that going to come back and get me in 6 years' time? And I, and this is what I'm like, you know, I hate to go to defensive medicine. You know, we, there was, we talk about MRIs and X-rays for back pain, and you hate to go for defensive medicine. But at the moment, I feel like that's the only way to move forwards to protect yourself as a clinician at the minute, because as you said, there's none of that guidance there for, from a legal perspective as to, okay, if you, if I are, you come to me with back pain, if I ask you about bladder and bowel, sexual function, you know, saddle anesthesia, and you say no, and I say to you, if you get those symptoms, you need to go to A&E, and I document that I've said that, is there any legal guidance that if you then in a week's time go to your GP and say, I've got these, I've had them before I saw that physio, am I legally covered because I told you to do that and wrote it, or because you didn't answer? I don't know.
Well, I think at the moment it's quite clear that they, there's a circumstance where what we historically we would think that that is protected. But then by the sound of things, if you haven't appropriately, your alarm bells haven't appropriately flagged on the bilateral sciatica point, and then you've had to document probably a much crisper than you've described, then that's difficult. And we can't go retrospectively changing notes now. So it's like, where it's not just about the now, is it, as you're describing, it's the fact that there might be things in the system that, that could come to haunt all of us. And therefore, another, there's lots of consequences down the track, including the... sometimes it's harder to get people, get clinicians to take more responsibility, especially when they're not necessarily remunerated appropriately, or those jobs are not seen as attractive because they're not made attractive through various different mechanisms of reward that we have in society. And therefore, that's going to be another challenge where people say, well, you know, sod it. I've been otherwise frustrated for a few years at being stuck at band six, but sod it. I'm feeling comfortable now. If all I'm going to get is a load of hassle and be arguing on the phone with spinal fellows who have got a different policy, it needs to be uniform, doesn't it? It needs to be joined up, and that is a major concern. So there are more questions than answers so far, but I look forward to it progressing. Saw Chris Mercer on Twitter saying that he's going to maybe put an event together or something like that. We're certainly going to have a quarter of at least workshop, if not a main room session at the conference, although that's in October, so you know,
it's a bit silly
for us to say put a plug on it till then, but whatever happens, we will revisit that, and it's definitely our responsibility to do so.
And I think it needs to become joined up. It needs to have, we need primary care, you need A&E, you need the first contact practitioners involved in that conversation, because there's no point in, as you said, the physios going, right, well, we're going to set out this really nice guidance that, nice wasn't a pun, by the way, we're going to set this really good guidance out for physiotherapists, and then we start referring into A&E as we would deem appropriate because that's what our guidance says, and A&E go, no, we're not having that. So, you know, or primary care have got a different threshold, and they're referring into physiotherapy, and the physios are going, no, you need to go to A&E. I mean, where's the patient's confidence in their GP is going to go down the pot, or think that the physios, well, the GP didn't think it was an emergency, why do you? There's a whole host of implications. Regard, obviously, it's an emergency for the patient, but for the whole pathway, there's big implications as well. And we don't want to be bunging up A&E with emergency referrals that don't need to be there. That's a concern that's what's going to happen, and this is, you know, that's how defensive medicine goes wrong, isn't it? Is you just waste a ton of resources to maybe catch that one person. And I just, I'm not the person to be answered. I don't know what the answer to that is, other than getting all of those stakeholders in a room and coming up with a consensus over a time based on the evidence, based on legal history as well, and those people that are in that legal situation who are going to say, you know, if they're going to be the legal expert witness and they're going to say, well, this, well, that we need to know that. We need to know what that is.
For me, that's where I start to get uncomfortable, is that if there is a true case and it needs to be sharpened up, and I need to see, to my mind, I need to see an address from the physiotherapy fraternity to Graham Wilkes, who's referencing Nick Todd, and probably get Nick Todd's thoughts on this, including potentially on these microphones, perhaps, as to whether or not there is a suggestion that we are, that as a general, in general practice, including in extended scope practice, including what we felt was evidence-informed, sharp-end practice by the true experts in the field, including those three, there's actually still been a bit of complacency with regards to Coda Equina on the fact that there's been under-referral for urgent MR from us and others, then that is something that definitely needs to be cross-party. It needs to be cross-sector. It needs to be secondary and primary care. But it also needs to make sure it gets through to the job-in 70-hour-week F2 that's who's doing his spinal fellow training that might be triaging these things at A&E. Or perhaps the time is now, because of the FCP movement, that essentially at least someone in each department is allowed for, in these circumstances, on specific criteria, to be referring for urgent MR to a local unit. And the governance that is required for that, if that's not an obvious access, especially because some departments I've worked in, even what do we mean by urgent MR? I mean, urgent MR, to my mind, is within 24 hours. It's what you certainly want if that happened to me right now. And certainly how I've had with family members, as you know, I've had a direct experience with that, which we can come on to. But if we've even got ambiguity over what do we mean by urgent, urgent becomes within a week. There's a two-tier thing where it's like we pay for it so you can have it tomorrow. Otherwise, it's within a week, and the machine breaks down, and they're not necessarily bumped off the list. In part because they're rolling their eyes over the fact that, well, I've just had a complex polytrauma in. Not a great example with MR, but if I would say a complex polytrauma in or something like that, I'd take priority over, and sometimes understandably so. But if they had what we consider hardcore requirement signs, then they'd definitely be even ahead of them on the list. But actually, because it's a bilateral sciatica, if the whole system involves people that are rolling their eyes at that and feel like it's overcautious protective medicine, then I'm concerned. Yeah. I mean, we'd all prefer to lean on the side of that second block, but if there's a good case for a lowering of the bar, then we need to visit that. I think, whilst not necessarily professionally correct for me to say so, we've got to be mindful that even in the current system, we've all known patients, if we're honest, which many people aren't, because it's not polite to say that there are patients and systems and special interest groups that will suggest that these are the things you need to say if you're not getting an MR or a third or fourth MR on or being taken seriously in the NHS or in the health system or in general. And that is a concern, where by lowering the bar, we then naturally will find that people that are being not even overtly dishonest on some of their symptoms, some are, but generally speaking, there's this notion that they know someone or someone else that was in their group or on their message board that then were escalated and taken more seriously because they had some urine retention. And so they got the MR that told them the problem, or the MR that reassured them even. And so that's something that does concern me, is we're naturally going to move potentially to a place where there's more of that going on, which makes us then... The more that happens, the more physios you have in the system that then just down tills and say, yeah, whatever. And then it is defensive medicine. You just sort of browbeat and you think, well, sod it. MRIs for everyone. Yeah. You can have an MRI and you can have an MRI.
Well, yeah, I think those would be quite small numbers. But we're talking about small numbers of Corda Equina anyway. I'd be interested to know if anybody knows how many Corda Equinas come through that have been delayed. Like, I haven't seen anybody quote anything that says, you know, in 2016 there was 1,000 Corda Equinas that saw a healthcare professional and had their care delayed because they didn't ask the right questions or they didn't escalate them appropriately or whatever it is. I assume that exists somewhere, but I haven't seen it. Because you know, this is the other question, is if it was 3 in 2017, I mean, okay, again, you say it's not great to say. For those 3 patients, it's terrible. But if you think the number of back pain patients that are coming through the system, if you've missed 3, that's bad luck, you know. There's got to be some context to the escalation.
If there isn't evidence that there could have been much done, in that circumstance,
yeah,
apart from blanket MRs, which is what is essentially being proposed.
Well, we had the same.
Like there's a really, it's a blunt instrument.
We sort of had the same thing with, I can't remember, but 2 or 3 years ago with X-raying all frozen shoulders, didn't we? Yeah. We had the same. It's not the same outcome potentially, but we had the same sort of conversations. Well, maybe we should X-ray all of our frozen shoulders, and then you know, it turns out we probably shouldn't bother.
It became policy until the recent, recent data that comes out of IPOPS, which obviously I'm very aware of, and essentially that has been a turning point in which it became policy. It was routine. I've worked within that system, and essentially the three that were picked up that were routine X-ray that then found something, it's highly unlikely in those three circumstances that they wouldn't have been a rationale for that X-ray independent of the mandatory. And so in those circumstances, you can't help but want similar sorts of data where possible before you lower the bar, because the system isn't equipped for that spike in referrals. And of course, we know the downstream effects of then, you know, hopefully 95% of those MRs plus, you know, 95% plus are then coming back what would be considered clear for Coda and Quina, but inevitably
show
demonstrating
up whatever.
Some relevant and irrelevant findings. Are we equipped as a profession and as an industry for that? Especially as the people that us talk about reform all the time. It's hilarious if we're suddenly going to say, well, we will deal with that appropriately. And we will all be expert communicators. It's like, we know even the best of us can struggle under those circumstances when there's appropriate correlation, but not correlation for severity or not correlation that's sufficient for it to be structurally causal, we could argue, and therefore surgery required. Obviously, tricky language there because it's very individualized. But lots of, you know, I feel like we could go on, but I definitely want to get on to the next topic, which is interesting, which would be useful. Do you want to get another beer?
I'm all right.
You're all right?
Yeah,
it's fine.
Should we have a check if there's any questions? I don't know.
We can see,
how do we do
see
that?
If anyone's weighed in. Usually on Facebook we would, but this is our first time on Periscope because Facebook seems to be down. So let's see if...
It doesn't seem like anybody's commented, if that's how that works.
I don't know. It works though on Periscope. Sorry if anyone's tuned in and asking anything, but we're trying.
Send us a DM on the Physio Matters account. I can pick that up if you've got anything you want to chuck at us.
Yeah, apologies if... I mean, it looks like people are watching, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they've piped up. But anyway, that's fine. But we definitely want to be talking about
vigilantes.
The next thing, which is similar. There's plenty of differences there, but there's also some similarities. The first thing is I missed it once again.
You've been in a cave.
Yeah,
quite
the top commentator, aren't I? So I missed it initially. Turns out, from what I've looked back over, so I only saw it kick up on Twitter and sort of, I think outrage is a fair assessment, really. There were a lot of that. And so I was thinking, right, let's make sure there's no smoke without fire. And in this case, there isn't. There's plenty of fire. And it turns out it traces back to Meekins doing a pre-gym piece to camera, 10-15 minutes, in which he just riffs. And he's totally off script, and it's certainly far from an auto-cue. And he just speaks his mind, and he's reflecting on the fact that a couple of recent manual therapy blogs, where I've read one of the two, I think, and more of the same from Adam, and he's sharpening up some of he's hardening some of his positions. He's being quite absolute on some things, and he knows I disagree with him on some of the oohs and ahs on that. And we saw him at our conference last time, in which, you know, there's nothing new in that direction. However, when he's applying that across the board, and he's now making the case about the fact that he hears off people that are feeling obliged, especially in private practice, and in his reference in other countries as well, which I know less of, where people are feeling pressurized to lay hands, and for that style of care that we all know is rife being out there. When he speaks to that, before we get to, that's his analysis, right? Before we get to what he might propose as a solution in this instance, which he's walked back, and we'll come to that as well. But we think about analysis, right? One of the biggest frustrations I have with the people that are against what he then goes on to say is that, without due credit to the fact that I'm genuinely intrigued if anyone has the data, or they think that they are gobsmacked to hear this, but most of us, and anyone I speak to, says that everyone knows people that have been pressurized into that. Everyone knows people that have lost jobs trying to rehabilitate patients instead of seeing them 10 times from an Ipsen manual therapy. Everyone's seen people that first day on private practice, it's, this is how we do acupuncture here. This is how you do a lumbar manip and a cervical manip here. And it sounds flippant. And I'd love to suggest that that's a minority. But essentially, because it's so rife, those anecdotes, it's difficult to enumerate. But it's cutting against so many people's lived experience to suggest that that's actually just a falsehood. So to suggest that Adam's analysis is totally bizarre and just utterly biased, that is going to annoy people. Now, of course, what he then goes on to is different. But before we move on to that, do you seem to be nodding at me. And I think we've had this conversation as a team where surely it needs to be that people will openly accept that that is a fairly substantial corner, if not a majority, within practice in physiotherapy, especially in a private sector, which, as we know, and we'll come to why, is ungoverned. What are your take on that analysis?
I think there's a few points here. I think Adam suffers a bit from what he said in the past. So regardless of what he goes on to say, he can't win in some sectors of the profession. Fairly or unfairly, and again, we can come back to that. So I think there's that to start with. I also think that corners of the profession are, I don't want to say blinded, that's not the right term, but they don't see that kind of practice, or if they do, they are having the wrong types of conversation with that type of practice. So, you know, we all know, we spoke about it earlier, we're all autonomous practitioners. You take the patient in front of you, N equals one, you use your clinical knowledge, you use your evidence base, you use your the patient's preferences, and you create a treatment plan. Now, that's brilliant, but it's also very easy to hide behind, in my opinion, you know. And I understand why people use manual therapy. I haven't used a lot of it, mostly because I've never been that confident doing it, and I've never found that when I have done it, it's given that much benefit to my patients. That's maybe my bias kicking through. But I think this argument of gaining patient buy-in and allowing you to do exercises, fine, by all means, as a rationale, I don't have that much of a problem with it. But I think it can be used like an excuse to use those kinds of practices that you're talking about that might be better for your pocket rather than better for the patient. And I wonder how much of a just rose-tinted glasses people see these conversations through, or maybe they're just not having those conversations with people. Me and you, we have a, you know, the however many thousand of physios are on Twitter, we have a wide spectrum of people to talk to. But, you know, we wouldn't have met physios who aren't on Twitter, aren't on Facebook to having these professional conversations. And maybe they don't have that awareness of what conversations are necessarily going on in the profession. If you were to only get your physio news from Frontline, you'd never know that these conversations were happening, and that maybe SIJs can't be put back into place by manips.
Yeah, we're not talking just about unscrupulous cowboys.
No.
They know they should do better, but don't. Mm. These are often people that are just underinformed, and I accept that.
And you know, we all come from different backgrounds. We all have different ideas of what we want to achieve from our careers and all this kind of thing. And I, you know, there is nothing, in my opinion, if you have a patient in front of you and you treat them for 10 sessions of manual therapy, I sort of don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is the reasoning behind it and what you're giving to that patient as a reason. If I struggle to think of a clinical scenario where I don't bias myself against it, but if your genuine belief was that is how manual therapy works and you haven't had that exposure, I can sort of defend that to a degree. But the cowboys that you're talking about who are forcing other physios, that's far worse to me. If you're forcing another physio to do that kind of treatment, that's going against their clinical autonomy. You're taking that away from them. That's almost worse. And then you've obviously got the added impact of maybe manual therapy is not the most cost efficient of that person's time coming in, spending their insurance money, spending their own money, spending the NHS's money. So I think it's a real complicated mess of problems. And I do think that there is some place for, you know, I had a conversation on Facebook the other day. People say, oh, this hands-on debate is crazy. You know, there is no hands-on, hands-off debate. Even Adam like touches people. You know, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but this debate of hands-on, hands-off.
It's a clever way of framing it, though. I think that's one thing to worth mentioning. Mm. It's just like, you're going to find. So if someone held a gun to every physio in the world's head and said hands-on, hands-off, based on literally hands-on or hands-off, you're just going to get so few people that would go for hands-off. But it's a clever way of framing the debate in order to, and the use of language there is relevant. But when, with that though, I am then in a situation having only retrospectively gone back and then watched the live stream, He's riffing and speaking on that, and I mean we're sort of famous Meekins apologists in a sense. Is that even when we disagree with him, we're liberal defend enough to sort right of to defend the right stuff, to say it. We were always doing that, but in this instance, and we'd still defend his right to say it. But he then basically goes on to say that he thinks maybe the governance system is so shot, and the experiences that he's hearing about and the frustrations that he's had, particularly over the thing we've just mentioned, especially in private practice, where you've got this pressure and obligation to go through the motions and entertain the clinic owner and things like that. Makes me shudder, especially sat in here. Now you can imagine what I tried to tell Mark Reed to do anything. but generally speaking, he's saying that maybe it needs, therefore, a vigilante justice WikiLeaks style event in which there is a name and shame process on clinics. He doesn't mention specific individuals. Now, in this instance, I get frustrated from Adam in a sense, and he's not thinking about it at that time, but it's just that as someone that is aware of all of the reformative action that's going on behind the scenes, including his involvement in it where possible, and the amount of people that are trying to reform governance in part because of an agreement with his analysis, then that sort of burn things down style vigilante approach is frustrating. But then admittedly to me, so is the reaction. I mean, it was so visceral.
Yeah.
And actually, if you watch that stream, there's no clarity from any of the analysis that came that it was about, I disagree with this 30 seconds, or even references the specific material. It's sort of therefore, it's the easiest thing in the world. And I think it's accidentally in many parts, but it argues against the straw man, really. It builds it up. There's a, you know, oh, there was a pile of straw there. Adam will admit to that. And he's now admitting it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Quite quickly, in fairness. But then it's been designed into a straw man that's argued against as if it was a policy or a proposal by a powerful body. And the responsibility of him as a public speaker is often one of the things that is definitely tricky. And I accept there's some nuance there. But my looking at it, I were really disappointed when I listened back to the stream and read the blog that Neil had done, which we'll come on to, and read all the Twitter threads today and thought, well, I really expected it to be a much more, be more there, because people were even, and this is one of my pet peeves as well, and I don't know who it was, or I'd mentioned by name, but I can't remember, but there were a couple of people giving it, think of the students. It's like a please think of the children sort of argument, as if to suggest, what if they stumbled across it? And even the suggestion that we can't trust these governance processes, and usually it's by people that have this naturally conservative, small c conservative approach to thinking that the systems are robust enough and that the governance frameworks that exist for that whistleblowing are sufficiently active and working, which most people at the moment kind of recognize need what we would argue is reform, others argue burning to the ground in this case. I find it really frustrating that the overreaction is surely, if not to the quantity of the mistake here made, but That only made me disappointed when I went to read it. But also, that hysteria cannot be healthy. I just don't understand how that goes. And I'm not just trying to, you know, I think that emotion, I'm not trying to drag emotion out of this. I'm not trying to be over objective. I just think that having observed it seemingly from the outside, I'd argue, and understanding the positions on each of it, if people are usually the same people that want less Twitter storms, surely caused a lot of the Twitter storm.
I think the irony for me was, if you look back through Adam's history of winding people up, there's a lot of people saying that he is offensive in whatever way he is offensive to them personally. And if you ask Adam, and this is where we've defended him to a degree, is he only, in my what I've seen of him, he has only ever criticized ideas. I've never seen him say to someone that they are a bad person for doing whatever or whatever it is, you know, criticizing their personality or whatever it is. But, and people will still criticize him for that. They will say, you know, he's offensive to people and all this kind of thing. And whether people take offense at what he says is an irrelevant point to the one I'm going to make now. Because, as you said, the reaction on Twitter and Facebook was one that was directly personal to Adam. Obviously, his idea was absolutely bloody terrible. And fine, you know, I think we all, whoever reacted with that blog, was like, you know, it's a bad idea, don't do it. And I think by the time he'd almost finished his live stream, he realised it was a bad
idea. Came back out of the gym.
You know, the fact that he even made the analysis to WikiLeaks for a guy who then had to hide in an embassy.
Ecuadorian
For however long, years or whatever. You know, he knows in down deep down, obviously, there's a legality problem to that. So, you know, it's sort of irrelevant, but to then attack Adam personally as well on top of the bad idea was absolutely rife. And, you know, I saw comments that were like, you know, that Adam's destroying the profession. And, you know, and to be honest, I think he's done as much for the profession of, you know, he's got a huge social media following of, I don't know what his Twitter account is, but, you know, promotion of the profession, he's got to be way up there with managing to get reach to non-clinicians as well. And I think a lot of the messages he makes are extremely good. And, you know, he has some harder end messages that people might not agree with, but it'd be boring if we agreed with everybody. So, you know, I can't.
And that points to why we find ourselves, again, defending his right to say it. And it's worth mentioning that because essentially a lot of the tweets that were coming out were suggestive. And I don't think people notice it as they're doing it, but there was suggestion that, don't worry, this has been flagged with the relevant authorities. This is something that can be added to the portfolio or the dossier against it. And it's just that difficulty where it's a pattern of behaviour and a cumulative effect. And there's some parts of it where the personal and professional are interlinked. And unfortunately, much like some of the ideas that Adam and others criticise, are so ingrained in people's personhood that they feel that they wound them, even when it's playing the ball, not the man. The man gets taken out with the challenge. Similarly, Adam needs to understand, as I think sometimes all of us do, where essentially when they are then pushing back against similar ideas, when in this instance, there's very few people hold quite hard views like that, that would be willing to go piece to camera for 15 minutes on a fairly overt topic and be bold enough or brave enough to do that undrafted. Whether that's wise or not, I don't know. But one of the interesting things, Twitter was very personalized. Neil wrote a blog on Matt Lowe's blog, and obviously we're big Neil Langridge fans and continue to be, but I'll declare it now, and I'm sure I'll get a chance to speak to Neil about it, but I've only just had a chance to read it, otherwise I probably would have had time to take the pace off it and speak to him directly, but I'll admit that it is particularly passive-aggressive for him to write a blog that doesn't... I mean, it's all right. It's not. We're saying don't attack people, and therefore don't just suddenly, like some people did on Twitter, just say you are the scourge of the profession or whatever. Even if you feel it, I mean, you can say it, and it's water off a duck's back. We know it is to him, but recognize the hypocrisy. I suppose we're saying.
Yeah.
But with Neil's blog doesn't mention that. It's like it's a shadow boxing. So he's been able, and again, accidentally, because we know that that Neil can be scalpel sharp when he wants to be. But in this instance, has decided to simply speak at this generically, and therefore it's just a blog that, whilst of course you agree with it, you agree with it by design. It's a set of platitudes that explains the current governance process, which, whilst useful to many people, doesn't necessarily reference the point. You know, surely there's where is there any credit to the argument that the governance system needs tidying up and reform, which, to my mind, and he's not said otherwise, I think Neil is seemingly incredibly supportive of the big R's, but I don't think he's like, I'm supportive of the big R's, but leave governance alone.
Yeah.
He's never already said it, so I don't believe that. But then the fact that you can read that blog and agree with all of it, but then just think, well, there's clearly something here that you must be referencing in order for it to be pertinent. And you're saying a Twitter discussion over the last 24 hours and stuff. It's like, you know, if ever there were appropriate time to reference tweets or at least reference this video that clearly has sparked it, that for me is disappointing, because as a man, I know he's better than that. And I felt it was passive aggressive, because it's not. That's where, not to point the finger to shake a fist, but to at least be specific, especially when the specificity, when it was brought to bear, by my mind, had been walked back enough by Adam at that point. But the weight of history, I think, is important, clearly, on that. And it's probably worth us as recognising that this is easier for us to analyse in the cold light of day. But from having had chance to do that and understanding all sides of it, I feel like I've been frustrated, not just by the idea and the premise being terrible, but also the reaction. I just can't see that as being helpful.
The thing I come back to when I think about this is, let's say you made that video, there wouldn't have been the same reaction. You could have said exactly the same words as what Adam said, and there wouldn't have been the same reaction. And that's not fair. Regardless of what Adam's done in the past, regardless of what he's going to do in the future, regardless of how many swear words he puts into a sentence, it should not change the fact. If you're outraged, the amount of outrage that you have should not change depending on who's delivering the message. So if you did it, if Neil made that video, you know, Neil never would, but you know, you might. You're an example where you might actually make that kind of video. But I can't see the same reaction. It seems to be, and that's, I think, where people are, they don't like being accused of attacking someone's character, but just by having the level of outrage because Adam did it is attacking Adam. And I think that's a hard line to tread, and social media generally, that's the way it's directing our social interactions. Everything is reactionary. It's so easy to become overreactive when you're just sat behind your keyboard. Yeah. And, you know, we know Adam well enough. We know he's not in any way the terrible bloke that people have made him out to be in the past. And I think that actually people need to, sometimes you wish there was a 20-second buffer on when you press tweet, yeah, and it just doesn't allow you to do it after you've finished typing and allow people to walk back so they don't react like that, because they wouldn't react like that in person, and you shouldn't have a different persona to on your Twitter account than you do in person.
Pending would be a nice touch. I want to take some, I know where you're coming from with regards to it. It shouldn't matter. It should be independent of who says it. But the context and history does matter.
Yeah, patterns of course
it behavior does. Clearly do a bit. And so people having the pause and poise to just wait a second and then react to it and try to recognize. And this is why I always talk about this, affording charity to whoever it is you're talking about. Before you find yourself biting, ask for a little bit more detail just in case you've got it wrong. That's obviously my go-to strategy, and plenty of people continue to disagree with that. I mean, to my mind, I wish there was a good in between that as a style of openness and just understanding and patience, and there being people then say, why are you talking about regulation? It's because I explain to me that middle bit. And me and you have had this before. Tell me about the middle bit, and you'll have me signing up so quickly. But tell me about what you'd suggest. And usually they then suggest regulation or a narrowing of the discourse. And one of my biggest frustrations is, and whilst I get frustrated by relativistic thinking, compared to what in this instance is definitely very relevant, because when it comes to Adam's online behaviour, barring a few mistakes, most of which he's apologised for, but particularly clumsy personalised mistakes that reference personal spats that he's had that other people aren't aware of, that they see as being more overt personal attacks and stuff like that. And again, we sound like apologies for it, and I accept that, because there's a bravado to it and a brashness that we, if we were really into it, would have followed suit on. We haven't. We offer a distinction, but the kind of frustration in that regard is that he is in this situation where, when he's done something like that, if it is truly offensive and those ideas are something that worries you and it's disgusting and it's a suggestion that he somehow has any sort of soft power sufficient to then bust a WikiLeaks-style scandal. And in this instance, I think that's what spooked people, is that they think that if he's willing to share that as a Google document or a Google sheet, I suppose he does have the exposure that he'd be, as long as he, and it, that'd be thing, it was talked to. And so I can see why people would be like, that's feasible in if he's thinking in that direction. But as soon as he's walking things back, if you're thinking that's super offensive and he's walking it back fairly quickly, then why would you want to offend the masses by perpetuating that fire? I always find this intriguing. Like, how is he solely responsible? You've actually then hyped that up because it suits you to suggest that that's actually got some momentum. And I think that that's that, you know, who barked first sort of approach, where there's a professionally outraged and morally outraged group, and it varies in its characters, by the way, that then will see it as being currency. And because it's such a clear sin that's unforgivable, it's the thing that they can leverage. And then their behaviour can't be scrutinised because it's not, I'm reacting to this. And the reaction is relevant. I am increasingly suspicious, as people that are content producers, and we've done that for a long time, we also then commentate, and some of our production, including this one, is commentary. But we try and make it. We're all frustrated and fed up if we're not producing and we're just reacting. We're all bored very quickly. There's people that are, it's almost a cottage industry now of just commentating, just reacting to, just seeming to take the pace off the ball and then musing on it after the fact, and usually musing on only a corner of the point. And so it's a straw man in of a sort that I think is a concern, and I could do with people the best way to do that, because I think there's a place for that sort of material, but I'd be less suspicious of it if they were producing more, if they were putting their ideas on the line more overtly without obvious sort of semi-reference to other material. We should always reference material, but it's like, I'm not saying it has to be a unique thought or an embryonic new idea, but it's definitely something that I think people, including myself, would have more respect for a something a bit more overt, where it was sort of like, when people are putting their ideas on the line, even if it's clumsy like that, if you're not the person that will sit in front of your phone for 10 minutes before you go into the gym, which most people aren't, I rarely do it, but we're a rare breed when we do, is that recognizing the context that you clearly don't understand, because you do understand and opt out of, is to then recognize that it's everyone's responsibility on, again, another big R, for sharing that responsibility, to think that what can we do better to not, say, make that minor couple of minutes of a 15-minute video than a storm piece? Because I can't help but think that it's all too easy to then think, right, let's muse on it and reflect on it, let 48 hours pass, and then be able to reflect not on the whole, but on particular incidents. Mm. And in this instance, it is the same critique I had, and we talked about in my podcast with Matt Lowe after the first instance on the first Big R's event, was that it was like a brilliant analysis that came through from him, that was a reaction to a particular moment of a particular part of a day that was then suggested as representative of the whole. And, you know, and Matt walked some of that back, which was great, but it was... And because I don't think it's purposeful, that's the thing. I don't think this is a sinister sort of a game of chess that's being played. But I think that I tried to suggest that that was happening. It's like we need to not all keep making the same mistake. It might suit our biases and suit sometimes our agendas, again, subconsciously. But that is something that we can't be the only ones that are seeing through it. And I think we need to be better if we are truly trying to collaborate. Or is it just clever, passive-aggressive point scoring that's to keep appropriate distance for professional gain or social gain? It's this idea of anti-tribalism, and it's been talked about quite a lot recently. I had a good exchange with Helen Preston about this. It's like, for me, it's like, I think we're on the same page, apart from the bit where you don't accept that your bit is also a bit tribal. You an outrage mob can still be a tribe that's actually in a majority against an individual. It's just that when the individual idea might be overtly poor, or you feel that their behaviour is sufficient, then it's the ends justify the means. And so to my mind, that's what I'm always talking about, is that we need to be consistent. But others just think that that's too loose, and that's a concern. Do you see it as being, and this is when I said compared to what, do you feel that, and we can ask this question about Adam specifically, even, but also the profession in general and how we interact in a digital space. If you compare it now to 3 or 4 years ago, and then if you compare it to pre-digital, to when we had our special interest groups, professional networks and stuff, like when we were first graduating and stuff like that, before that's this digital space and open conversation, which part of that is most or least tribal in terms of specific camps? What would you say? Because I have my answer, but I'd be interested in whether you think more or less now.
I think we've gone through this funny transition where you mentioned the special interest groups, and I think that was... We sort of with the tribes in that sort of thing, and you think back into your physio history, and you had McKenzie versus Maitland or whatever. Not versus, a terrible turn of phrase, isn't it? But you have different schools of thought maybe on how to treat a patient. We've gone from that, and I feel like when I first started using Twitter, it broadened out. Everybody broadened out. There wasn't anything. It was people making points, people discussing points, and we alluded to it earlier, where I don't think Twitter is anywhere near what it used to be in terms of usefulness. And you would, you know, even down to, you'd have papers being, and people would discuss the papers, and you know, I used to get involved in the physio talks and all those kind of things. You know, it was great. And I think we've gone back into, this is my belief, I'm going to defend that and look for things to follow with that and disagree with things that are disagreeing with that. And I think we've gone back, and I would love it if we could go back to that middle ground, which lasted maybe 2 or 3 years and finished maybe about 18 months or a year ago, where it suddenly, and I think it's to do a bit with reactions, it suddenly has become a point scoring contest, Twitter, I think.
It's coincided with the societal shift in that direction as well.
Of course,
it's only
it has.
Become more and more toxic in the political climate, and that bleeds in as well. There isn't an overt distinction, and nor should there be, between the personal and the professional. And no one thinks they're the bad guy. And so these people that are sharing material about what they think is just an obvious thing. And I make the same mistake, you know, satire and stuff like that, which is just, to my mind, the fact that it's satire is to ridicule and to suggest such an obvious thing that's silly. But to someone else, that would wound them. They might not say anything at that point, but then they will marry that to the next tweet, which is about clinical stuff that they feel like is similarly abusive. And it's like, it's tricky. I do think it's a tricky space. To my mind, compared to back then, the opportunities and the inclusiveness and the openness is far broader, because you can quite literally engage. And we're witnessing that, more patients, more students, more new graduates. It's like, that's for me where the evidence is. Yeah. Very few people push back on that. But then also, I think there was this middle spot where it wasn't just inclusive, it was also that it would take an awful lot more tweets to actually fire things up. But also, I think it's because there's nothing new under the sun, and you might still have a core group of people, including Adam, that's been round the block, that potentially it's not as if some of those original conversations about the specific utility of K-tape, and Meekins was always involved in that because he used to use the stuff, and he was actually a bit of a fan historically, and so his journey he's become more entrenched, and therefore many could argue that if you're supportive of that narrative and even are willing to apologize as we do in some ways, or account for it, then potentially people can suggest that that's tribal. But it's like, well, if it's a tribe that also links in with every other tribe that exists and opens and gives platforms where possible to every other tribe, it's like, well, that's a hell of an open tribe. It's like, to my mind, just bring more in. You know, if you try, I think there's a great quote where it's like, as soon as you try to draw a line around me and my group, then we will break that line and only bring you further in to make the group bigger. So it's like that is sensible. But similarly, as a profession, there is an outer wall that is about professional decorum and what you are expecting, what the code of conduct and the legality of what you sign to, where you do forgo your freedom of speech in a professional capacity. And that is where very few would argue about the outer boundary, but it's the idea of just how tense we have it in. And my biggest fear, and the only reason why I don't sign up for some of the suggestion that we should just all be kinder and nicer and things like that, is that I think that self-censorship to stop people saying anything. And one of the things that I think is happening on Twitter is that people are just less, increasingly, compared to a couple of years ago where they didn't think that they could have an embryonic idea that wasn't going to be shot down. it was a sweet spot, but people were able to do that. Just let me float this and bat it around a little bit and then not feel embarrassed to then walk it back. Now it's a situation where it's floated. If there's an idea that's floated, it's not quickly shot down necessarily, but unless it's in a particular direction, which is usually that it doesn't stand for anything specifically, it's sort of always in a subjective direction. It's always sort of inferring or suggesting, you know, we've always got this nuance clickbait now where it's like if it's an ooh or an ah or some sort of generalized platitude about, like, you know, if you get 100 retweets for saying, listen to your patient now. And it's like that just kind of, you'd have needed, and I don't know whether that is a clickbait of a kind, that it's sort of like, what is that achieving? If that is the only thing that we're somehow, that the reward network is perpetuating, then no one's going to really stand for anything where they say, like, you know, where they actually stand up for something that's against the grain. We're going to get too much orthodoxy. And I think that the reactionaries are actually fighting against that to make sure that we've actually still got something interesting to read, something interesting to say. And if we police it too tightly, then people are just going to self-censor to a point in which it might be pleasant, but it's also bland. And people then disengage because of that.
Well, I think we've got to that separated state now. It's either you've got something completely benign and bland, or you've got something that's overreacting. I don't think we've got any of that middle ground left in Twitter or barely at all. You know, I think infographics over the last year are the only thing that I would say have actually come out as a positive of Twitter. If you think about, I mean, I used to have a reading list that you get links of articles and you couldn't get through them, and that's not how I find them anymore.
Fortunately, I'm not that arsed about Twitter in a sense. It's like people sometimes think that it's like what we do is live or die by that, but it's never had 50% of our listenership that's on Twitter, and so essentially now it's hard to know because you've not got all personalised accounts, but as a general rule, it's an important platform for us for feedback and things like that, but generally speaking, it's like if that dies, then long live the next king. It doesn't really matter, but it's just a shame because there was this sweet spot, and can it be improved? Yes. But when it's compared to yesteryear, it's just like that's where you lose me. It's like, God, we're far less tribal than we were when we graduated, trust me, because we're breaking that down. And the conversations, MACP are in a positive conversation now about inclusivity as to how to break down the walled garden that's existed with regards to access. If they're the Musculoskeletal Association of Chartered Physios, why is their access point an MSc and specific MSCs at that? That is being talked about. And that is... that wouldn't have been a conversation for many years. So these are all really promising signs to my mind, and we can all be sort of hopeful. I mean, funnily enough, and it's not, we're not trying to do a full loop, but essentially, that is what the Big Oz is for, isn't it? It's like trying to find a consensus and then lobby around that consensus and having it as something that is appropriately involved in various different things and can be debated appropriately. And then the consensus is drawn around a significant majority of positive voices that can back it up with evidence-based thinking, as well as that understanding of how philosophy meets science and understanding the map between the population-level data and the lived experience. And so to my mind, that's hopefully what it's for, and hopefully people can feel involved and included in that. But similarly, it's not as if that involvement or inclusivity is going to be something where anything you say goes if you dig your heels in and just stand by it and not necessarily be able to articulate what is it about your opponent's point that you either agree or disagree with. And that for me is where I think that we're not always clear, and that's up to me to improve our messaging. But hopefully the punchline is that these things are, the platforms are a bit hostile and a bit hot at the moment, so let's create new ones, let's make sure that we do better in-person discussion, have better events, which of course gives us a chance to plug more tickets, doesn't it? But I don't know if you've got any final thoughts. We've been on an hour, so we'll wrap it up.
No, I don't think so. I think just on your point of the conference, I think we ran our first two Big R's events as invite only, and, you know, we were criticised, probably rightly, for making that too inclusive. Exclusive. Sorry, I get my ins and exits too exclusive, but there were reasons we ran it like that, and we've talked about that before. But we did then open it up, and, you know, reform.physio /community, anybody can join up, you can join in that conversation there. And the idea behind that is to create that conversation ground. We as a team, we moderate it, and if people are are not making good arguments or attacking the person that's made the argument, then we'll prevent them from making those posts. And I think that's where we need to be better, is having civilized conversations where we disagree. Because it'll be boring if we all agreed. I don't want to agree with everybody. I don't want to agree with you and Adam on every single point. I think it's fun to disagree to a point, because everybody's different.
The atmosphere at the conference, even though there were plenty, there was no one forcibly agreeing or disagreeing. But there was plenty of friction between
heated
ideas. Yeah. But it was like there was still a good atmosphere. Now that's a sweet spot we hope to maintain. Yeah. reform.physio/community, sign up for an account. The interface for the forums and the file share and stuff like that, we are well aware, needs some work. we are absolute amateurs in that space, but it does function and people are enjoying and downloading the resources that are there. Trust me, they're going to become more abundant as we work towards this manifesto, which is going to have policies and proposals. Have a look on the teasers, hashtag the big R's for that, and all the graphics that have come out recently. We've also got another 5-minute video that explains the project, explains what it's trying to achieve as well. That comes out in the next couple of weeks, but there's a 1-minute one about why we're calling it a grassroots think tank. So lots more to come. Do check out the website for all the details on booking for the conference. Thanks for listening to this as a bonus episode, and certainly more production from us with regards to patient matters, health matters, and here we are at Physio Natters getting a rebirth. And so thanks, Jack, for coming in. We better go and get some food, mate.
Yeah, I'm all starving.
Right, nice one.